content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 1st, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a snowy graveyard scene. In the foreground is Vladimir Putin. He is dressed in a Grim Reaper outfit, black cloak with a hood. He's got a staff in his left hand, and his right hand is resting on a headstone that says Alexei Navalny, 1976 to 2024, with a picture of Navalny on it. The headline is Burying Dissent: What the Death of a Putin Critic Means for Russia and the World. That is our first main story. We'll start right there. U.S. readies sanctions after Putin foe dies in prison. What happened? The Biden administration vowed this week to impose major sanctions against Russia after the death of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, as an increasingly emboldened President Vladimir Putin appeared to be tightening his crackdown on internal dissent. Russian officials say that Navalny, a charismatic anti-corruption activist who for years was Putin's chief antagonist, fell unconscious and died after a walk at the Arctic prison where he was serving a 30-year sentence on extremism and fraud charges. Prison authorities say Navalny, 47, had succumbed to sudden death syndrome. But foreign leaders, opposition activists, and family members blamed Putin. Navalny, who in 2020 narrowly survived being poisoned with the Soviet-era nerve agent Novichok, had appeared healthy while addressing a court hearing by video the day before his death. Make no mistake, Putin is responsible for Navalny's death, said President Biden. The death of a widely revered dissident prompted shock and anguish among supporters and condemnation from world leaders. Memorials sprang up across Russia with thousands of people lining up in frigid temperatures to lay flowers, which in many cases were swept away by authorities. Videos shared on social media showed mourners being seized and arrested, and there were reports of police beatings and passports being examined. At least 387 people were detained, according to the human rights group OVD Info, including a priest who was arrested outside his home after he announced plans for a memorial. Navalny was our chance at freedom, said Yulia, a 24-year-old at a Moscow vigil. With him, we really had a hope that everything could change. Putin, who was unusually jovial in a public appearance the day Navalny died, did not mention his foe publicly. Navalny's death comes weeks before an election in which Putin, the longest-serving leader of Russia since Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, is assured of winning another six-year term. Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, vowed to carry on his legacy. My husband was unbreakable, so that's why Putin killed him, she said. The main thing we can do for Alexei and for ourselves is to keep fighting. What the editorial said. The sad truth is that Navalny's political assassination has tightened Putin's autocratic grip, said the Wall Street Journal. But it is also exposing the illegitimacy of his rule, as mourners risk arrest to honor Navalny's memory. Their bravery shows Putin hasn't killed the courage and conviction of ordinary Russians whom Navalny inspired to hope for a better future. That's Navalny's greatest legacy and his most fitting monument. Navalny's murder should remind Putin's Republican enablers in Washington that he's a cold-blooded killer who remains a danger to the free world, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson, and other deluded MAGA devotees who gloss over Putin's atrocities and oppose further aid to the Ukrainians fighting his forces in the trenches are emboldening a dictator who fears freedom and hates the West. With Navalny dead, domestic dissent crushed, and Ukraine on the defensive, Putin will be hunting for new targets, which could include NATO nations. What the columnist said. MAGA Republicans, take note, said Noah Rothman in National Review. This is what actual tyranny looks like. Trump and his allies have long indulged in ludicrous comparisons of President Biden's regime to real-world autocracies, such as by portraying January 6 defendants as political prisoners. Now Trump and others are likening his criminal prosecutions to Navalny's imprisonment and murder. There's no real difference between the two cases, said far-right gadfly Dinesh D'Souza. Apparently, Navalny's horrifying fate is still not enough to impose on them a crisis of conscience. Navalny's killing was shocking but inevitable, said Andrei Soltudov and Irina Borogin in Foreign Affairs. He was a master agitator who cleverly exposed terrible abuses and misdeeds by Putin's regime, drawing tens of millions of views with YouTube videos exposing and lampooning the opulent lifestyles of Putin and his oligarchs. For citizens besieged by an ever more repressive regime, Navalny was a lone unifying figure who enjoyed extraordinary, boundary-defying popularity. Even behind bars, Navalny was too big a threat for Putin to ignore, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic. When he returned to Russia from exile in 2021, after being poisoned twice, he knew he'd face arrests and possible death. In doing so, he inspired millions as a model of what civic courage can look like. And for a dictator who rules through lies and violence, that kind of challenge was intolerable. Now Putin must do battle with Navalny's memory, and that's a battle he will never win. Perhaps, but Russia, for now, is undeniably Putin's country, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. As his war with Ukraine enters its third year, he's survived international sanctions and geopolitical isolation from the West. His opposition is cowed, suppressed, and scattered. Republicans in the U.S. are trying to block new funding for Ukraine, and he'll glide to another term next month in a farce of an election. As the relentless tightening of his fist continues, Putin seems to have cemented a new era of Russian dictatorship. Controversy of the week. Biden, does his reelection campaign need a reboot? For better or worse, we're about to see more of President Biden, said Maya Ward in Politico. Democratic Party operatives have for months worried that the 81-year-old president's low public profile was feeding concerns about his age. Only this month, Biden declined the traditional softball Super Bowl interview, and in 3 years has held a mere 33 press conferences, compared with 52 for Donald Trump and 66 for Barack Obama. The recent release of Special Counsel Robert Hur's report, in which Hur recommended against charging Biden for mishandling confidential documents, saying a jury might balk at convicting a well-meaning elderly man with poor memory, has only added to Democrats' concerns. With a new poll showing 86% of voters think Biden is too old for a second term, top party officials are begging the White House to send the president out in front of the country much more. They want to give voters a more visible, livelier image of the man currently trailing Trump in head-to-head polls. The strategy has obvious risks, said Mike Allen in Axios. At a press conference where a fired-up Biden hit back at Hur's report, he confused the presidents of Egypt and Mexico. But with Republicans planning public hearings on Biden's mental fitness, His team knows something needs to change. Fast. Getting out there is Biden's only hope, said Jonathan Alter in Washington Monthly. Is there a risk of more blunders if he carpets the airwaves with TV interviews? No, it's a stone-cold certainty. But exposure will let voters get comfortable with Biden's flubs, realize that he's basically okay on a cognitive level, and start focusing on the contrast with Trump, an incoherent 77-year-old pledging to govern as a dictator in a second term. Age isn't the only concern to Biden's young progressive staffers, said Matthew Iglesias in his Substack newsletter. They also worry he'll slip up and confess personal qualms about abortion or some other mainstream view considered cringe by the left. But Biden's centrism is what got him elected, a strategy that reintroduces voters to their moderate, old but effective president would be a win-win. Oh, please, said Noah Rothman in National Review. If Biden could put on public displays of cogency and vigor, don't you think he'd be doing so already? It's more likely his campaign team is keeping him hidden as they know he can manage only fleeting moments of lucidity aided by a teleprompter. Biden's aides insist he's sharp in meetings, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times. And I can't point to a moment where Biden faltered in his presidency because his age had slowed him. But being president and running for the presidency are two different jobs. The latter requires a performance of capability that seems beyond Biden's reach. The good news, it's only March. Not too late for Democrats to choose and rally around another candidate. That's pie-in-the-sky wish-casting, said Michael A. Cohen in MSNBC. Unless Biden steps aside voluntarily, which he won't, there's no mechanism by which Democrats can jettison him. Sure, he could suffer a health emergency, a non-remote possibility at 81, but would hopefuls like California Governor Gavin Newsom and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer risk stepping over the country's first female black president, vice president, to make a White House run? No, they'd set their sights on 2028, endorse Kamala Harris, who has worse approval numbers than Biden, and sail into November with lower odds of victory than today. For all his liabilities, Biden is Democrats' best, least risky choice, and that's why they'll stick with him. It's a good week, bad week. Good week for sailors. After the Navy relaxed its long-standing ban on service members putting their hands in their pockets. Personnel are now free to place hands in pockets, so long as it does not compromise safety or prohibit the proper rendering of honors and courtesies. It was a good week for dressage, with the reinstatement of Australia's Olympic team of show jumper Shane Rose, who was temporarily pulled from the squad for wearing a mankini at a costumed equestrian event. They're not a comfortable bit of gear, Rose said of the Barat style G-string. When you put that on a horse, even less comfortable. It was a good week for merch after Donald Trump unveiled a line of $399 gold color sneakers at SneakerCon in Philadelphia. The super limited run of 1,000 Never Surrender high tops sold out within hours. But it was a bad week for stainlessness after some Tesla Cybertruck owners reported that specks of rust had appeared on their vehicle's stainless steel exteriors. I think as long as you don't drive it in the rain or get it wet, it will be fine, wrote one member of an owner's forum. It was a bad week for taking one for the team after Sacramento State outfielder Matt Masciangelo was hit by a pitch a record 7 times during a doubleheader against Loyola Marymount. In post-game comments, Masciangelo said he was grateful for the on-base percentage bump. Finally, it was a bad week for peer review after the journal Frontiers in Cell Development and Biology apologized for publishing a nonsensical study that included an AI-generated diagram of a rat with a penis more than twice the size of its body. The studies, Frontier said, lacked scientific rigor. This week's briefing, titled Iran's Axis of Resistance. Tehran has built a network of proxies across the Middle East to expand its influence and fight against the U.S. and Israel. What is the Axis of Resistance? It's a loose alliance of dozens of Islamist militias, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen, which receive funding, training, and weapons from Tehran. These proxies let Iran project power in the Middle East and militarily challenge foes such as the U.S. and Israel while assuming a veil of deniability. The U.S. said the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas, for example, gets $70 million annually from Tehran and used Iran-supplied weapons in its October 7th attack. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei hailed the massacre of 1,200 Israelis as an epic victory, but Iranian officials publicly denied any involvement. The Axis, whose name is a play on President George W. Bush's 2002 designation of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as an axis of evil, has mobilized on multiple fronts following October 7th, and the outbreak of the war in Gaza. Militants in Iraq and Syria have bombarded U.S. bases, killing three American soldiers in Jordan last month. Hezbollah has lobbed missiles into Israel, and the Houthis have attacked commercial shipping and targeted U.S. Navy vessels in the Red Sea, prompting U.S. retaliatory strikes and raising fears of a wider conflict. Iran doesn't want an all-out war, said Kuwait University professor Badr al-Saif, but all of this tit-for-tat could backfire and cause more havoc in a region already on fire. When did Iran start building this alliance? After taking power in the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran's new theocratic Shiite Muslim regime recognized that most powers in the Sunni Muslim-dominated Middle East were hostile to its existence. So the mullahs sought new allies to serve their strategic interest, finding many partners in weak, often failing states. In 1982, Iran began training Shiite militants in Lebanon to take on the Israeli forces occupying the country's south. Those militants became Hezbollah, which means the Party of God, which today receives some $700 million a year from Iran and has a 100,000-strong fighting force. In the 1990s, it backed Shiite opponents of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Those groups turned their fire on U.S. troops following the 2003 invasion of Iraq. When civil war erupted in Syria in 2011, Iran equipped militias loyal to dictator Bashar al-Assad and recruited 70,000 fighters from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Iraq to crush the Sunni rebellion. In Yemen, it rallied behind the Houthis, a Shiite group fighting the Saudi Arabia-backed central government. Not all of these groups share Tehran's radical Shiite ideology. Hamas is Sunni, but they support its goals of resisting the West and eradicating Israel, which it calls a cancer. How does Iran direct its proxies? Largely through the Quds Force, the external arm of its elite Revolutionary Guards. In the late 1990s, the outfit was taken over by Qasem Soleimani, an expert in irregular warfare who grew the Quds Force into a regional powerhouse with divisions focused on intelligence, finance, politics, sabotage, and special operations. Militias under his oversight killed at least 608 U.S. troops in Iraq between 2003 and 2011, and his Quds Force helped turn the tide of the Syrian civil war in Assad's favor. Soleimani also strengthened Tehran's relationship with Hamas after it was hit with international sanctions for strong-arming its way to victory in Gaza's 2006 elections. The Quds Force smuggled missiles and weapons into Gaza through tunnels from Egypt, and when Egypt cracked down on that operation, it helped Hamas develop arms manufacturing facilities. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad in January 2020. But cooperation between Axis members has only intensified under new Quds Force leader Esmail Khani. Iran has been working on what it calls the unification of fronts surrounding Israel, said Middle East expert Kim Gaddis. It is a more logistically coordinated operation rather than each group doing its own thing. Is Iran in full control of the Axis? Not always, because each group has its own agenda and ambitions. The Houthis in 2014 seized the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, against the advice of the Quds Force, and some experts say the group's targeting of Red Sea shipping may serve its domestic political interest, distracting Yemenis from a collapsed economy and widespread hunger, more than those of Iran, which is keen to avoid a direct and devastating war with the U.S. The Houthis are very well backed by the Iranians, said Yemeni political analyst Hisham Omaisi, but they're not puppets on a string. U.S. intelligence officials also believe that Tehran does not have complete authority over the Islamic resistance in Iraq, the umbrella group of militias that carried out the deadly attack in Jordan. Still, President Biden said he held the Iranians responsible for that strike because they're supplying the weapons to the people who did it. How has the U.S. responded? Together with Western allies, it has tried to disrupt and degrade the Houthis' offensive capabilities, striking dozens of missile launchers, radar systems, and weapons storage sites in Yemen. And following the attack on Jordan, the U.S. carried out airstrikes and bombing raids on more than 85 targets in Iraq and Syria, targeting Quds Force command and intelligence centers, weapons facilities, and bunkers. The White House said it doesn't want war with Iran, but Biden warned, if you harm an American, we will respond. Iran analyst Banim Bin Taleblu argues that such retaliatory strikes are not sufficient to deter future Iranian aggression. Every time you hold only the proxy accountable, he said, the patron will live to fight another day. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Trump aims to keep his family on top. Donald Trump is setting off on a new ground of in-your-face nepotism, said Michelle Cottle. Having given Republican National Committee Chair Ronald McDaniel the heave-ho, he now wants his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, to co-chair the RNC with Michael Whatley, the head of the North Carolina GOP. Laura is an extremely talented communicator and is dedicated to all that MAGA stands for, Trump gushed of his son Eric's wife, a former Fox News contributor and failed pop star. You might think Whatley's energetic embrace of Trump's election fraud baloney would suffice to secure the GOP as a MAGA fiefdom, But in matters of fealty, Trump is a belt and suspenders kind of guy. And after all, family is family. That's why he brought daughter Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, into his White House last time, and why he could go further if he wins again. We could see Don Jr. knocking heads as chief of staff, and daughter Tiffany, a recent Georgetown Law School graduate, as attorney general. Ivanka could be secretary of state, and while Kushner says he has no more government aspirations, plans change. Whether any Trumplings are fit to serve isn't the point. The MAGA king doesn't care about any qualification other than blind loyalty. Gun violence has us scared and lonely. It's simple, said Joel Mathis. Guns ruin everything. At the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl victory celebration in Kansas City last week, an argument escalated into a shooting spree that left one bystander dead and 22 other people wounded. Some 1 million people had gathered to be a part of something we all could take joy in, yet the day ended in horror. Two men were charged with murder and two teens with resisting arrest and gun-related offenses. There's no equivocating about the cause of this bloodshed. There are too many damned guns in the hands of too many damned idiots in this country. Given the perniciousness of American gun culture, we know that mass violence is possible, even likely on any given day. The U.S. had 656 mass shootings last year. It has become impossible to worship or attend school or even celebrate a local triumph without worrying that some nut will enact their most sociopathic tendencies. Each one of these shootings only makes us a little more scared of each other. No wonder we're grappling with an epidemic of loneliness. Given the risks, next time there's an occasion for mass celebration, why wouldn't you just stay home? This column comes from Norway. Destroying the Arctic for profit. Norway has unilaterally decided to plunder the Arctic, ravaging one of the world's most pristine environments for its own profit, said Simon Holstrom. A new law authorizing deep-sea mining, passed by the Parliament in January, opens up an area of Arctic seabed roughly the size of Arizona to both exploration and exploitation. In becoming the first country in the world to mine the sea on a commercial scale, Norway says it wants to break the stranglehold Russia and China have on the trade in rare earths, as well as gain access to the cobalt, copper, nickel, and manganese it will need to make batteries and solar panels. But the extraction of these minerals involves big machines grinding up habitats, releasing large plumes of toxic sludge into ocean currents, smothering marine life. No wonder environmentalists are calling it ecocide. It's a clear violation of the European Union's laws protecting the environment, but since Norway is not an EU member, it can't be prosecuted in EU courts. Still, the European Parliament has passed a resolution calling on Norway to respect its international obligation to not cause harm beyond its own waters. The international community must follow suit and pressure Norway to abandon its mad plan before it's too late. Last word, our feature article, title this week, Plunging into Peril. Athletes like steep skier Jeremy Heitz are taking extreme sports to deadlier terrain, said Simon Ackham in The Guardian, with sponsors encouraging ever greater risks. The Combine de Valserie is a rocky alpine peak that stands 13,700 feet above sea level near the Swiss-Italian border. Its northwest face rises 2,200 feet at a gradient of about 50 degrees, steep enough that you can stand on the slope and touch the higher ground beside you without bending down. In May 2016, when Jeremy Heitz climbed the Combine for the first time, the northwest face of the mountain looked like a vertical curtain of white, fringed by bands of dark rock. In several places, smears of grayish ice darkened the snow cover. Heitz's ascent was nothing extraordinary in mountaineering terms. The face was first ascended in 1958 by Egbert Iger and Eric Vanis, but Heitz was not climbing the Combine because he cared about going up. His plan was to ski down it. Heitz, who was 26 at the time, is a professional free rider, a skier who spends his time on wild mountain slopes far from groomed trails and resort boundaries. His specialty lies at the extreme end of free riding, steep skiing, descending ground with a gradient twice that of some expert terrain in ski resorts. This activity combines two of the world's most perilous sports, alpine mountaineering and backcountry skiing, and regularly kills a handful of its practitioners every year. Heitz had come to the Combine as part of a film project that he had devised called La Liste, or The List, which involved descending some of the steepest and tallest faces in the Western Alps. Heitz would not be the first person to ski the northwest face of the Combine. That accomplishment was secured in 1981. But the pioneers of steep skiing, who developed the sport in the 1960s and 70s, had relied on so-called pedal hop turns, making one staccato leap after another to deal with the impossibly precipitous slopes. Heitz had a different vision. In his early days, steep skiing's drama had come from the fact that these slopes could be skied at all. Now Heitz sought to bring speed, up to 75 miles per hour, and style to a sport that once impressed through sheer audacity. The result was something remarkable, and even riskier than before. "That style of skiing is incredibly dangerous," says Dave Searle, a British mountain guide based in Chamonix. "You can keep pushing the limits of it until you either stop pushing the limits or you die. That's the two things, really." At the top of the Combine, Heitz stood on a crest of snow that curved like a frozen wave. He looked down at the clouds in the valleys far below. "You ready?" someone said on the radio. A countdown cued the camera crew hovering nearby in a helicopter. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Heitz slid sideways down the first few yards, made a turn, and then cut down on to the highest gray smear of ice. Skiing on ice is not generally recommended. All skiers control their speed by making turns. That's how they tame gravity. But on ice, the edges of the ski can't bite, which means you can't turn, which means you can't slow down. Instead, you become a vector, pure speed with no directional control. Heitz believed he could handle the ice, and he thought it would make good footage. He was wrong about at least one of those things. On the ice, he lost control and started sliding. One ski came off, and he began to tumble. "No, no, no," he shouted. He was lucky. The Combine, unlike some of his other proving grounds, is concave, with the steepest section at the top. He halted himself after falling perhaps 500 feet. He says the exact distance is hard to judge. The loose ski slid further below him before it, too, came to a stop. "You okay, Jeremy?" the radio burbled. Heitz drew an ice axe from his pack and hacked at the frozen face of the slope to secure himself. He went down gingerly to retrieve the lost ski. "I really frightened myself," he radioed back. "Let's call it a day." Heitz grew up in the same region of western Switzerland as one of the pioneers of extreme skiing, Sylvain Saudan, who made his name in the 1960s and 70s with regular descents of mountain faces that were thought to be unskiable. Heitz's idea for La Liste had been to redo his predecessor's path-breaking descents, albeit with a twist. He compiled a list of Swiss and French mountains with enormously steep faces, hence the title, and decided to ski them in grand style at high speed. Like big wave surfing, extreme skiing has always carried an existential charge. Its dangers are not incidental or extraneous, and death is not a rare accident that only occurs when things go terribly wrong. It was for the sake of one of his viewers, his mother, that Heitz had been initially reluctant to include footage of his fall on the combine. He was not eager to show her how close he had come to dying that day. But one of the editors of La Liste, a Swiss filmmaker named Nico Facchette, who had known Heitz since he was a child, insisted that the fall belonged in the film. It was, he said, the most dramatic moment. Heitz eventually relented, and today he says that showing his fallibility on screen was central to the film. "This," Heitz told me recently, "is the simpler reality of this kind of skiing. There are times when things go well and times when things go badly," he said. To see Heitz stumble and fall in the middle of a film full of inhumanly beautiful performances was to be reminded just how dangerous what he was doing truly was. Before La Liste, Heitz had been a well-regarded, if largely unknown, professional freerider. After La Liste, his name was spoken with awestruck admiration. The success of La Liste offered Heitz and his skiing partner on the project, Sam Athematen, immediate material rewards. Today, Athematen is supported by the U.S. brand North Face, while Heitz has become a favorite for European outdoor brands. Heitz currently makes about 300,000 Swiss francs, about $350,000 a year. Many pro skiers would count themselves lucky to make a fraction of that. The sponsorship money has allowed him to focus entirely on his film projects. For all the freedom that Heitz sponsorships have provided him, it also seemed clear to me that this freedom comes with its own kind of restraints. Though the brands themselves say they never demand that their athletes take on certain objectives, in reality it's more delicate dance. As Nico Facchette says, many skiers feel that if you don't deliver material that is both dramatic and beautiful, your contract is likely not to be renewed. It's business. I mean, if you can no longer deliver your rolls to all the cafeterias in the region, they will look for another baker. To spend much time in Heitz's world is to encounter something like the normalization, even the banalization of premature death. To be honest, there are so many deaths that it's not like it's the elephant in the room, because it's not a secret how dangerous backcountry skiing is, the American skier Drew Tabke told me. I was speaking to him shortly after the death of Toff Henry, a French freerider whose style was sometimes compared to Heitz. "Toff, who just died, is one of like 20 of our friends who have died. I know dozens of people who have died. And there's not that many practitioners." After La Liste, Heitz and Athematen, a specialist in rock and ice climbing, wanted to take their style of steep skiing beyond the Alps. Sylvain told me, "Jeremy, the Alps are over now. You have to be somewhere else. In the Himalayas," Heitz said. "For skiing and for me, that is the future." La Liste was made on a budget of 130,000 francs, most of which was swiftly absorbed by the cost of the helicopters needed for aerial photography. This time, Heitz and Antemottin were able to secure about 2 million francs, $2.3 million, for a film, the majority of which came from Red Bull. That was enough to take a filmmaking crew to the Andes and to the Karakoram in Pakistan. Their first target was a 19,760-foot blade of ice and rock in Peru called Arte San Raju. In 2018, Heitz, Antemottin, and the other three members of their crew set off for the summit from a camp on the glacier below. It took 12 hours to reach the peak, with the final stretch on a narrow ridge. On the way up, the snow conditions seemed good, but the winds they met during the climb had transformed the southeast face into a mix of crust and hard ice. Mika Merikanto, a Finnish photographer and experienced steep skier, went first. He skied down the first third of the face, then radioed to say the conditions meant high-speed sweeping turns were not possible. Antemottin and Heitz followed, taking on board the advice and eschewing their usual grand style. The two athletes paused briefly where Merikanto was standing, then continued on their way down. In the interim, waiting, Merikanto had become very cold. He set off again, but lower down the face, his ski hit a concealed rock, and he lost his footing. His skis came off, and soon he was cartwheeling down the mountain. Watching after his own descent, Antemottin thought Merikanto was dead, but Heitz, about 500 feet away, traversed furiously and was able to reach Merikanto's sliding body in time to stop him, using his own body as a barricade. "It was so steep I couldn't move," Heitz recalled. "It took an hour before anyone else in their crew was able to reach them." The team was eventually able to contact the Peruvian authorities on a satellite phone, but they said it would take 24 hours for a helicopter to reach them. It was clear that Merikanto would not make it that long. He had sustained a spinal injury, a punctured lung, damaged both knees and an elbow, and had a bleed on the brain. He was drifting in and out of consciousness and was rapidly becoming hypothermic. The crew decided to bring Merikanto down the mountain themselves. Merikanto recalls that Heitz was next to him when he woke up in a rural Peruvian hospital. Heitz told him he was done with skiing. "He was blaming himself for a lot of it," Merikanto told me. "Blaming himself so much for it. And I guess I was just trying to calm him down a bit." La List 2 premiered in 2021, subtitled Everything or Nothing. It is a very different production from its predecessor. The film is primarily the story of Merikanto's injury and rehabilitation, along with Heitz's growing uneasiness about the risks involved in the project. His decision to turn back on Lila Peak in Pakistan, while Antemottin continues, is portrayed as a signal moment. Merikanto appears to hold no grudge against Heist. They remain friends, but he finds it hard to justify the risks involved in the sport. "It's a waste of incredible people, personalities. I feel it's a waste," he told me. "Somebody dies, and then on the next day you have your social media full of this ride in peace bullshit, and then the circus continues." When Toff Henry died in October last year, he was with Mathurin Vautier, a French photographer based in Chamonix. Afterward, Vautier published a long post on Instagram describing what had happened to Henry and Juan Señoret, the Chilean skier who died in the same accident. It read like an anguished howl for lost friends. They were at the peak of their joy and their reasons to live. Skis on the feet, a sublime mountain, a sunrise, and with a partner who shared the same vision. Then below, Vautier added, "Finally, thank you to the sponsors. Without them, nothing would have been done in the same way." I wondered if he was aware of the irony, or if the brands listed were either. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in The Guardian. Thank you. one of the obituaries, the radio host who was the voice of the morning drive, Bob Edwards, 1947 to 2024. When Bob Edwards sat down behind the microphone on November 1979 to host NPR's Morning Edition, it was supposed to be a temporary gig. A pilot version of the new show had flopped, and after the Public Broadcasting Network fired the co-host 10 days before the launch, they tapped Edwards, co-host of the evening show, All Things Considered, as a fill-in. He stayed there nearly 25 years, guiding listeners through the day's stories and interviewing thousands of public officials, authors, artists, athletes, and other newsmakers. For millions of listeners, Edwards' resonant baritone and authoritative yet amiable demeanor were an essential ingredient in the morning routine. Everyone feels they know Bob, producer Ellen McDonald said in 1989, that he's their friend. For Edwards, that perceived intimacy was what made radio so special. When you watch news anchors on television, you're not under any kind of illusion like that, he said. It's magic. Edwards grew up in Louisville, where his father worked for city government, said the New York Times. Smitten with radio from a young age, he realized he had a voice for the medium when he would answer the phone and callers would mistake him for his father. Drafted during the Vietnam War, he worked for Armed Forces Radio and Television in South Korea, then earned a master's in journalism at American University. He shed his Kentucky accent to work at a tiny station in Illinois before joining NPR in 1974. In the ensuing years, he became one of NPR's most versatile and popular hosts, said the Washington Post. He pushed producers to do fewer interviews with politicians, whose predictability he found boring, and instead seek out more artists, activists, and lesser-known newsmakers. Edwards was abruptly ousted in 2004 when NPR decided that Morning Edition needed a makeover, said NBCNews.com, a move that sparked much outcry. Fans barraged the network with complaints, and Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois complained on the Senate floor about losing the most successful morning voice in America. Edwards soon moved to XM Satellite Radio, where he hosted The Bob Edwards Show until 2014. He then hosted a podcast for AARP. At times, he expressed bitterness at his firing, but he still spoke reverently of public radio. It's just a necessity, a national treasure, he told an interviewer in 2006. Asked if he ever listened to his own show now that it had new anchors, he replied, "Every morning." And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Start with the article, House GOP, a crumbling impeachment case. The Republican case for impeaching Joe Biden just got a lot emptier, said Molly Olmstead in Slate. Their star witness, an FBI informant, who made possibly the most credible accusation of corruption against the president, was arrested and charged last week with lying about, well, everything. Justice Department Special Counsel David Weiss said Alexander Smirnov, 43, fabricated claims that in 2015 or 16, Ukrainian energy firm Burisma paid then Vice President Biden and his son Hunter, a Burisma board member, $5 million each to quash a government investigation into the firm. More embarrassing for the House GOP impeachment effort is that Smirnov admitted he has ties to Russian intelligence. Smirnov told prosecutors that he met as recently as December with Russian officials, who passed him a story about Hunter. And this is the supposedly credible source whom the House GOP has repeatedly touted in its months-long quest to impeach the president. Republicans still have no evidence of wrongdoing by Biden. It's time to shut down the sham of an investigation. There's more than enough to keep probing, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. While candidate Biden claimed in 2020 that he was not involved in Hunter's business, his son's former business party, Tony Bobulinski, testified to the House last week about how the Bidens together peddled the family brand. When Bob Alinsky and Hunter worked with a Chinese energy firm in 2017, Bob Alinsky wrote an email proposing a 10% cut for the big guy, who everyone understood to be Joe Biden. And the big guy was on at least 20 of Hunter's business calls. Bob Alinsky's claims didn't hold up very well under questioning from the Democrats, said Joe Petriconi in The Bulwark. He admitted that he'd never talked with Biden about Hunter's business, and that despite saying he couldn't remember having any personal connection to Donald Trump, he'd been a Trump campaign guest at a 2020 presidential debate. Yet again, the investigation's supposed bombshell revelations wither under scrutiny. But hardline Republicans don't care about facts, said Greg Sargent. Already, MAGA types such as Donald Trump Jr. are declaring that Weiss, a Trump appointee who has indicted Hunter Biden on tax and firearms charges, is a deep state stooge. In MAGA land, when one big lie implodes, there's always another conspiracy theory lying underneath it. Putin, why he might put a nuke in space. Are we facing this generation's Sputnik moment? Asked Carrie A. Bingen and Heather W. Williams in the New York Times. Representative Mike Turner, a Republican from Ohio, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, set off a frenzy in Washington last week when he urged President Biden to declassify intelligence on an unnamed national security threat. A day later, the White House let the American public in on what had so alarmed Congress, a space-based Russian anti-satellite weapon, potentially armed with a nuclear warhead. U.S. officials emphasized that the weapon is still under development, said Katie Bo Lillis in CNN.com. But if launched and used, it would upend modern life on Earth. Banned under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the nuke would release a pulse of electromagnetic energy that would destroy constellations of small satellites, like SpaceX's Starlink, which has been successfully used by Ukraine in its ongoing war with Russia. It would also cripple the satellites that we all rely on for everything from navigation to weather forecasting to financial transactions. Washington doesn't believe Russia would actually detonate a nuke in space, said David E. Sanger and Julian E. Barnes in the New York Times. Instead, it would lurk as a time bomb in low orbit, a reminder that if President Vladimir Putin is pushed too hard by the West, he could destroy economies without targeting humans on Earth. Intelligence officials suspect Putin wants such asymmetric weapons because Russia's war against the much smaller Ukraine has revealed the limitations of its conventional forces. And one intelligence official said Putin believes that the U.S. would not risk a direct confrontation with Russia over the deployment of a nuclear-armed satellite. Don't panic, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Even the Kremlin wouldn't do something so insanely dangerous and destabilizing as detonate a nuke in orbit. The blast would also destroy Russia's satellites and those of China, India, and some 90 other countries, and likely spark a nuclear war, because the U.S. would assume a nuclear strike on the mainland was next. I think Putin's plan is to freak out the West and signal that Russia is done with pesky treaties and dainty nuclear niceties. As the White House notes, such a weapon is unlikely to be deployed soon, but the war in Ukraine is happening right now. We should be more concerned about an existential crisis arising from Russian military operations here on Earth than from a notional weapon system in space. Here's a couple of the shorter notes. Because of discord among the Republican caucus, the current House has failed 6 times to pass rule votes, routine procedural votes that set debate parameters before a bill goes to the floor for passage. Before 2023, a rule vote hadn't failed in 21 years. the price per square foot of condominiums in seven Manhattan buildings that carried Donald Trump's name fell 23% from 2013 to 2023, with a notable decline right after Trump won the 2016 presidential election. At four buildings that removed the gold Trump logo, the price per square foot went up 9% over the same period, according to an analysis by City Realty. Nearly two-thirds of American teachers say they are limiting instruction on political and social issues due to worries over complaints from parents and over whether their schools and districts would support them, according to a new survey. That's roughly double the share of teachers who live in areas that legally restrict discussions of race, history, sex, and gender in the classroom. And we'll finish today's program with a quote from Albert Einstein, quoted in the Washington Post. He says, "There are only two ways to live your life. One is as if nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.